Welcome back to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guests today are Betty Yu and Reiko Tahara, and we are talking about anti-Asian sentiment and violence, but also the importance and power of cultural organizing. Both of you are teachers and both of you are artists. I wanted to hear from you all your thoughts on the role of art, but also the role of academia in social activism. Reiko, do you want to dive in with that?
Sure thing. I teach at the Hunter College, which is part of City University of New York, that has 25 different campuses. So it's a huge mammoth school. And even within the Hunter College, I've been hearing from my students, and like my students reacted very strongly after Black Lives, after you know, May, June this year, in response to the Black Lives Matter, how they want to have a concrete change within their, you know, department, small department. And they were talking about, like, did they submitted the demand to hire one Black full-time faculty because we don't have any, and also decolonizing the syllabi, because many of the classes, I don't really know much about it, but, you know, many students felt that that even the social justice-oriented program like ours, they can learn about, you know, how to decolonize syllabi and, you know, like including the readings and films, who made, you know, those, and like who wrote those, who made those, and, you know, how we can include and celebrate, you know, Black brilliance, or like, you know, the BIPOC authors and artists, like, because they are missing from the history of a documentary, history of a film, and those kind of things. So students, you know, demand it. And then I heard a similar story happening at the MFA in studio art and dance department. Like, dance department students reacted strongly when the administration canceled a lot of BIPOC dance classes, including hip hop and, you know, yoga, and you know, like a Chinese dance and things like that. So students demanded to reinstate those classes, and I think hip hop too was reinstated. So there was a Zoom meeting. Like, we put together a Zoom meeting with a bunch of students from different art disciplines and also theater. Like, theater students are demanding to have more variety of a play that they decide to perform together, because the, you know, what faculty suggests are not, you know, authored by BIPOC authors. And so there's a many different things going on. And I thought it's really meaningful that students from different art disciplines come together and discuss about their experiences and share knowledge and, you know, and discuss how to really successfully change things. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful to see what kind of movement would happen from the students. Like, it has to be student-led. And also, I was really intrigued by this group called Diversity Our Narrative. And this is, you know, this is like started by mainly Asian American college students in California, and they demanded, started this petition campaign to write to the government, the local government throughout the United States, to demand one BIPOC author, you know, material that was written by one BIPOC author in the history or English writing classes in the high school, in the public high school. And, you know, and they, of course, you know, forefront the Black experience and as an ally. So I was very, like, kind of warmed by those Asian American young women, you know, coming to really embrace their people of colorness and, you know, forefronting the bigger battle by Black women or Black, students, to really celebrate together, and also, you know, demand together. And I think their movement is growing, and I would like to support it. And so I'm hoping this, the people of color community would come together and recognize the difference, our differences, and also the common experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's inspiring. And Betty, would you like to weigh in here?
Sure. I think I agree that there's all this activity and organizing on the student level. And the classes, that sounds great that those are being reoffered. But I also want to touch on the importance of getting into the structural the necessity for challenging these educational institutions, the city agencies, the city government, from a very structural standpoint, if we're really going to see real change system-wide in our schools, in the public schools, and universities, and the city government. You know, because even Pratt Institute, you know, they put out a solidarity statement, like, we stand with Asian communities and all kinds of art institutions and all kinds of folks, right? And that's great. You know, to a large degree, my cynical self as a New Yorker, I say, oh, well, you know, performative politics only get you so far. Performative, you know, solidarity politics only get you so far. What are you going to do? What are you willing to put on the line? And I think that a lot of these groups that are coming forward with a more radical perspective are putting out solid ways, for instance, that the mayor's office, the city government itself can allocate more funding to diversifying not only less sort of like a New York City, the school system staff, but teachers. Who are the public school teachers? And oftentimes they live in Long Island, or they're you know, we've lost so many black teachers in the last 25 years because of testing and all this stuff that is just mm-hmm. like systematically under Giuliani and Bloomberg. We've lost so many teachers of color in the New York City school system. And I noticed that even a lot of the Asian teachers that I know that teach at Pratt or other higher learning places don't necessarily have a racial justice analysis, or they're lacking in a deep one. A deep racial justice analysis. And so I think that has to happen at all levels. So I think one is that there needs to just be funding for the city to recruit more and encourage more Asians and people of color, African-American, Latino teachers to be teaching. And then, you know, the second thing is obviously for these private universities and CUNY and SUNY to be doing that, and obviously across the country. But the other last thing I wanted to say is that when there are incidences in schools, and my partner is a teacher, so I know pretty intimately from stories he tells me, he's also a union leader within the union of teachers. And oftentimes, there, you know, when there is anti-Black or anti-Asian sentiment that is expressed in these schools, the resort is always to call police safe, school safety. Mm. And so can we find more restorative justice, more restorative ways to deal with this kind of issue? I think that's super, super, super important. And definitely like decolonizing the curriculum, but to like, yeah, show more. And I'm very much about this. I actually been talking to other educators about this. We need to teach in the K-12 schools and in the universities the contribution of Asian Americans to civil rights struggles. The Black and Brown and Asian solidarity has deep roots, you know, especially in the 1960s when Asian Americans were calling for Asian American studies. It was because they were so inspired by the Black liberation movements and Black civil rights movements that they were so inspired that, you know, Latinx and all these other communities that were calling for ethnic studies as well in you know, in their schools. And I think that, you know, the mainstream suppresses that, but there is so much rich history of Asian and Black solidarity that we have to uplift in the schools, in K-12, and show that we're not the other, we're not the silent, mm-hmm. we're not the model minority that's anti-Black, because if we keep regurgitating that mainstream narrative, that's what the students are going to walk away with. Brown, white, Black, whatever, that's what they're going to, or even the self-hatred that I grew up with in my own community. You know, I was born and raised here, and I had so much self-hatred. I grew up with all Dominican, Puerto Rican, and African-American, and some white kids. I had so much self-hatred for myself. I can't even tell you. And that's a whole nother thing.
This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. We are talking with Betty Yu and Reiko Tahara. Betty, you just offered some personal information about saying that you grew up with self-hate. I did want to switch gears a little to the more personal side, because I was able to take a look online at the project you've been working on this past year, Intimate Distance, which features your parents. Could you kind of describe that? I mean, people can go online and look at it, but I would love it if you could describe it and sort of the theme of it. I found it very touching and very intimate.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So I started this project. I got a scholarship to do this International Center Photography program in new media, because I really wanted to embark on new media tools. anyway, long story short, COVID happened, right? So the semester was completely just online since March, right? And so the project that I had been working on was photography. It's taking photographs of my parents and the community in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, and how gentrification has impacted us on a very personal level. And then suddenly COVID happened, and then we were all scared, couldn't see my parents in person. So we had to carry on our conversations on FaceTime. And I explored this project with them. I said, hey, I've got all these archived photographs that date back to the 20s and 30s and 40s from my grandfather. And then I had just learned in the past couple of years that I had different generations of my family in the US, but because of anti-Asian sentiment, many of them had to go back to China, like my great grandfather, who was in Nevada. And so I was very fascinated with this. And so they agreed to participate in the project. And so it was me working with them over, as you can see, over FaceTime. My mom barely knows how to use the video app stuff. So we had to do a little training. My dad, as you can see, is a lot of foreheads and chins. My dad didn't know how to, he didn't know where to talk. He didn't know how to, he was just like, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And it was just so funny. But anyway, we, over a 3 or 4 month period, we're just doing Zooms. Mm-hmm. And I would occasionally look in a photo album and say, who's this and who's that? Can you just verify who these people are? And then doing research and just through my own family archive. And then as the increase of anti-Asian violence was happening, it felt much more necessary to create this project because right a couple blocks away from where my parents live, one of the first incidents that happened in April of 2020 was an Asian woman, a man just poured acid on her face as she was going out to take the garbage out, and she was disfigured. She had hot acid on her face. And that was, one of the first incidents I had heard of really in my parents' neighborhood. So it was very close to home. And so anyway, all that to say, through photography, photographs I had shot and video, as you probably saw, I try to construct this narrative of looking at today and COVID, and the fear of so much, not only anti-Asian racism, right? There's that, and then COVID and everything. And seeing how that Chinatown's, Brooklyn's Chinatown got hit really hard, like all the other Chinatowns, even before in January 2020, people didn't want to go there because they thought if they stepped into Chinatown, they would get COVID. And so the businesses have been hit hard. And so I just wanted to follow that trajectory. And I asked very personal questions to my parents. They've been married for 54 years or something. I'm very honest. Their marriage was somewhat arranged. I mean, they had a chance to date for a little while. And my mom tells me all the time, she's like, you guys in the US are too romantic, too, it's too emotional. She's like, a lot of people around the world marry for practicality. And I said, okay, economics. And I was like, okay, that's true. So I talk about how they've been distant from one another for so long, but COVID actually brought them together quite a bit to take care of each other. My mom couldn't escape and go somewhere because she is so annoyed by my dad. So they were stuck together, literally stuck together for 9 months before people started going out. And I just watched their relationship through my phone. So it's about that. And then it starts with the present and it goes back to, as you can see, with Yellow Peril and a lot of the anti-Asian violence that goes back over 150 years, but through my own personal story, which is really important for me to have it grounded in my own personal story. So,
well, Reiko Tahara and Betty Yu, thank you both so very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure and very educational. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nini and Lori.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. It was really great to be in conversation with Reiko, who I admire for so long. So,
oh, same to you.
And Lori, who I've known from way back.
This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. We're now back with Reiko Tahara, and for this part of the conversation, we're joined by her daughter, Moe Uesugi, and Moe's former professor, Dr. Elena Shi. Moe is a software engineer at Yelp and a recent graduate of Brown University, where she studied computer science and comparative literature. She is a Japanese-American born and raised in New York City, and after a brief stint in San Francisco, she has recently returned to New York. Dr. Shi is an assistant professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University and an outreach organizer with Red Canary Song, a grassroots collective of Asian and migrant sex workers. On March 26th, the New York Times ran an op-ed by Dr. Shi called How to Protect Massage Workers. We've been talking about anti-Asian sentiment and violence, and one of the things we mentioned earlier was the need for more education at all school levels about the history of various aspects of the experiences of Asians in the U.S., including discrimination and violence targeting Asian people. I'd like to dive deeper into that with Dr. Shi, but Moy, let's start with you. You emailed a little about what it felt like for you being a student in a mostly white middle school. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I grew up in Brooklyn in New York. So I was always surrounded by a lot of different people, a lot of different races, different backgrounds. But when I went to middle school, I was mostly white, like we were saying. And you know, in middle school, you're 12, 13, 14, you're just learning that maybe you can become an adult. And for us, that was like, you know, you trying on makeup, you're putting on, you know, fancy clothes and going out to dinner and taking pictures. And within all of that, like sort of becoming an adult inside of that environment where most of my friends were white, I really felt those differences in how we looked and how we were perceived in the world. But also, you mentioned education. This was sort of the first times that we were learning in our school curriculum about World War II, about Japan, about Japanese internment, about atomic bombs. And I remember really distinctly from that time, whenever we would talk about Japan, like all the eyes in the classroom would just turn straight to me, like, Moye, what are you thinking? What do you think about this? And that was just really odd to me because I was learning too. And I felt like I had to have an answer as like the Japanese person in the room.
Right. You had to speak for all Japanese people. That's a lot to take on or feel like you have to take on, especially in middle school. Moy and Reiko, you both have emailed that lately you've lived with a little bit of an increased level of fear. Could you talk about that, and could you share some of your, to the extent you're willing, some of your personal experiences? Reiko, I don't know if you want to start.
Sure. Well, it's not that I live with fear too much. I'm not too afraid, but, you know, this Atlanta incident certainly made me look back on what I have gone through, maybe, and then, you know, realize, oh, yeah, sure, I have some experience, and, you know, I wasn't really thinking in terms of, you know, being Asian. But yeah, sure. I mean, most recently, it involves Moe too. Moe and I were waiting for, like, with a grocery, like, we just shopped at the Trader Joe's, and we were, standing in the platform at the DeKalb Avenue station. It's like a, you know, gentrified downtown Brooklyn. And then it was before COVID, right? It was like right before COVID, like something like that.
Sometimes COVID, maybe.
And before, right? I don't remember. Yeah. So anyway, we were waiting for the train, and then some man approached us, and we didn't understand him, like what he was saying. And me being a friendly person, I asked him, like, well, sorry, I didn't understand you. Like, what do you mean? And then, you know, Moy was immediately annoyed by me answering, you know, like,
well, we were talking in Japanese at the time. And yeah. Like, to me, it felt like maybe I was just overreading it, but it felt like it was sort of coming over and being like, just sort of mocking what we were, like the sounds we were making. And so I was immediately what's going on here?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm like, you know, dumb. So I don't really notice those things. So I'm like, you know, what do you mean? Like, you know, I don't understand you. And then probably he was mocking us. And then he suddenly grabbed our head together and then banged it.
He grabbed your heads together, your heads and banged them together?
Yeah. Yeah.
Scary.
And I was wearing my glasses, so I was okay, but Moy got injured. I'm so sorry, Moy. So, you know, like when I looked up and she was like, she was bleeding a little bit and had a, you know, bruise kind of like, you know, she was injured. And then I didn't really understand what was going on. And the next thing I realized was how fiercely, like, shouting, you know, to the man, Moe was. Uh-huh. And Moe was like, what's up? Can I say that? Can I say that? Like, she was very, like, immediately swearing. And I was very proud of her, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, go, girl. It's like, I couldn't have done it, but Moe did it. And I was very encouraged by it. Uh-huh. And then I feel like, oh, I have to shout too. So I started shouting at him. And so we are like shouting at him. And then he, you know, he ran away. But then there's this, you know, young black man came to rescue us. And there were like a couple of other Asian groups on the platform, mm-hmm. but they kind of like kept a distance and they watched us quietly. Huh. But you know, this young man was courageous and he helped us. And you know, the man wasn't caught, but you know, we felt very, you know, relieved that someone was you know, was trying to help us.
That there was a bystander who intervened on your behalf.
Yeah, totally. They were almost like fist fighting, and I was worried about, you know, the guy who came to help us. But you know, nothing happened, and the you know, the attacker escaped, and yeah, and we just, you know, left the scene. So
wow.
Yeah, but yeah, it was, yeah. So it was, I wasn't really scared. I was more surprised how fierce Moe was, and I was very proud. So that's one incident. And then before that, I was just walking to go to the Park Slope Food Co-op in Park Slope, and then I was attacked, like surrounded by a bunch of about 10 teenagers, and you know, and I was like, you know, they were after my phone, and I fought. But I made really conscious effort. It was like a slow motion. So I really made a conscious effort to scream. So I, you know, luckily I could say, hey, help, you know, like it came in the second time. So like, you know, and then there was another, there was also, you know, someone across the street, another young black man who came, who said, hey, and he came over to help us and help me, and he escorted me afterward to my you know, destination. So I'm wow. Like, they are my heroes, and
I'm so really glad to hear that. And Moe, good for you. But so how have you been feeling lately?
I guess good for me. Yeah, I've been the mixed feelings, right? Yeah, like to some extent, I am a bit more afraid. Like I hear things about like people who sort of sound like me, like Asian women, like in their 20s, in train stations that like I usually go to, who have had things happen, like even in the news and stuff. And so it does make me afraid. But I guess you can kind of tell from that story. But I don't like feeling so I don't know, weak, or like, I guess who does? Yeah. But yeah, I think I don't really want to feed into the stereotype of like Asian women is like super weak and not able to take care of themselves. And so I am very conscious of like how much I'm fighting against that, just like personally.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dr. Shi, I would welcome you to share any experiences that you would like to offer. But I also wonder, when you listen to Moe and Reiko, does what they have to say, does that connect in any way with what you hear from people that you interact with through your work with Red Canary Song?
Thanks so much. It's really powerful to hear you as a mother-daughter team talking through hearing some of these experiences together, because I think we're only going to get through this moment with different kinds of intergenerational healing and connectivity. And I'll return back to that in a second. But
And may I interrupt to say, the audience can't see this, but we're doing this on Zoom. And what you are missing is that Dr. Shi is rocking her little baby on her lap right now. So there's another mother-daughter or mother-baby team there. Anyway, okay, sorry for the interruption.
Thank you for that. It's interesting you mentioned that, because my comments are actually on the theme of like invisibility and hypervisibility. And I think that we're taught so often to like hide the baby and keep the baby underneath. But thanks so much for making that explicit. I think on that, it is a moment of incredible hypervisibility for Asian women. So even if these attacks are not happening to us, we constantly hear about them read about them in news from friends. And so we're constantly on high alert. I think that's one of the most ironic things about having checked in with the massage workers that we do outreach with Red Canary Song. The days following the shooting in Atlanta on March 16th, we expected them to talk about how fearful they were that the same kind of incident might impact their lives, that same kind of like mass violence might reach them. And what they were more fearful of actually was of the subsequent policing that might arrive in order to protect.
Right.
And so there's this constant need to balance because Asian massage work is so often misperceived, I would argue, because of its adjacency to fears of trafficking and questions surrounding whether or not these workers who were killed were sex workers. I think all of these questions are relevant to the fact that everyone working in the Asian massage industry in the United States, largely low-wage service sector migrants, are subject to much more mundane forms of systemic violence. So yes, mm-hmm. absolutely, in addition to being victim and vulnerable to like the terror of like murder in these instances, the day-to-day violence of economic precarity, yes. Really to work in vulnerable situations because they can't afford housing, medicine, food, particularly in the aftermath of the pandemic. So yeah. I'd say that the absolute gross forms of violence that we saw in Atlanta are coupled with everyday forms of mundane terror that they're facing, yeah. But also new forms of police violence that emerge in the name of so-called rescuing or protecting people.
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about this show and reading things online about what bystanders can do and how to intervene, they always say, don't call the police unless the person asks you to. And that was interesting. And I can see why. I'm hoping actually that in the future, perhaps we can go do a show talking more about the issue of policing, about Red Canary Song, and so on. But we did want to talk just a little bit about education. And as a professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies, what do you think is lacking in terms of education about the experiences of Asian people in the U.S. in our school systems? And what would you like to see added?
I think I'd love for there be an attention to the systems and the state structures that undergird like individual moments in history. So I think that we often have like the module on, you know, Moy had mentioned Japanese incarceration, but that's never really connected to other systems of U.S. militarism or imperialism. Like, why aren't we learning about that in connection to the Vietnam War and the mass resettlement of Southeast Asian refugees to the United States? And then why are not we connecting that to the fact that 2 days just before the Atlanta shooting, there was a plane of 33 Vietnamese refugees who had largely lived in the United States almost their entire lives, deported back to Vietnam. I think that the more we learn across all of these systems, like really large systems, mm-hmm. the more we'll be able to interconnect our different struggles, our commonalities, but also our possible like hopes for the future in a way that doesn't silo us and pit us against each other so much. And I think I'd like to shout out to the incredible students in the state of Rhode Island where I live, high school students, middle school students who recently sued the state because their civics education did not include enough of their like diverse own histories. And so I think there's enormous potential for students all over the country, but that in addition to focusing on our students, we probably also need to focus on our elders and mm-hmm. thinking about how we might communicate some of the new lessons that we have, the new language we have to talk about these things, elders, and particularly amongst like Asian American populations, that is actually having the like linguistic tools to be able to speak in these different languages that our elders speak and to mm-hmm. be able to communicate.
Okay. So many levels there. It's what you say about the students in Rhode Island is very inspiring. I didn't know about that. You've been listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. In the wake of the shootings at three massage spas in Atlanta that killed 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian women, we have been talking about anti-Asian sentiment and violence. I thank Dr. Elena Shi, Reiko Tahara, and Moi Uesugi for joining us. Remember that there is a new group at MSU called Asia that is in the process of planning outreach and education activities. So be sure to look for those. You can hear Body Politic on KGVM 95.9 FM at 1 p.m. on the first and third Monday of every month. Stream it live or download it anytime at kgvm.org. Thank you all.